All right, Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session.
Good morning, and please be seated. It's, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're trying to remember if we've ever come to Mankato. I think this may be one of the first times, is that right?
First, last year was.
And want to commend the county commissioners for this beautiful courthouse and also the hospitality of the people here, the deputies and court staff made coffee, brought us chocolates, and we are ready to begin. And I know that you all are familiar with our rules. You'll have 15 minutes, and there's a timer each side with 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. And please come to the podium for your arguments. The first case is Arndt versus Commissioner of Public Safety. It's A19-0777. And when you begin your argument, please state your name for the record. We're recording everything. Thank you.
May I please the court, counsel? My name is Paul Malone, lawyer for Slade, Minnesota. Represent the appellant in this case. Obviously, this case was up before and was remanded and ended up to Judge Baggert for a determination regarding whether or not consent to the test was freely and voluntarily given. I'll make this fairly brief, I guess, today, but first of all, I'd like to direct your attention, or I will discuss Judge Baggert's specific findings. Judge Baggert, in his decision, stated the process of arresting the petitioner appears to follow protocol. Nothing in the record credibly suggests that the deputy threatened or acted abusively towards the petitioner. Now, I understand we're standing for review here, but the question then is the inaccurate statement that she'd be subjected to criminal prosecution. And it's our position that this is clearly an error to say that that's not a threat. To be handcuffed to the wall, to have an officer telling you, I'm going to charge you with a crime if you don't do something, is a threat. And to say that there was no threat is clearly erroneous.
But whether I agree with you or not, and I think there certainly is something that the second time the advisory was given, it was incorrect. And we all agree with that. No. But isn't that the threatening nature of that misleading advisory just one of the circumstances that a court is to consider in determining whether overall the consent is voluntary?
Yes.
And why is that particular circumstance so compelling here?
Because you have been it's totality of circumstances, Judge. You have the arrest at night, impoundment of the vehicle, the handcuffs, being handcuffed and hauled in a squad car. You're in the jail, and when they're in the jail, they're handcuffed to the wall. And so, by an officer in a uniform with a gun, and that's absolutely intimidating. I don't, you know, I see Judge Baggert wrote that the protocol is normal, that the person had some experience with cops. Well, I submit that if I was arrested, handcuffed, hauled in a squad car, and locked and chained to the wall, or handcuffed, I should say, I'd be intimidated. I've been around cops quite a bit in my life. It's very, very intimidating, certainly. And then for the officer, again, I guess we're getting into the part of my argument, for the officer or for judge to say, well, the person has some experience with the officers, they know that. Well, if you know what a crime is, you know the consequences of a crime. So it's getting beyond the answer to your question, Judge, I'm sorry. But if you have been in the process, you know that with a crime, if you've ever been arrested or prosecuted, you know that there's a lot of collateral consequences as well as possible jail, fine. And so the judge indicates that the protocol, or excuse me, that the prior experience with officers is indication there was no intimidation and there was no threat. Well, to be told it's a crime, when you know what a crime is and you've been through the drill and been prosecuted before, it certainly makes it more intimidating, right, that not having knowledge regarding the severe consequences of the DWI. I'm not downplaying the significance. I'm not saying that DWI is okay. I'm not making that argument at all. But we follow the Constitution in this country.
So you're suggesting that being threatened, or being told that her refusal to take the urine test was a crime when in fact it wasn't, her prior experience with it made that even more threatening statement?
Certainly, and that's directly contrary to what Judge Baker found. He argued the protocols, you know, she used the cuffs. No. Once you've been arrested and hauled in and through the jail and prosecuted and know all those consequences, it's more significant than if you don't. And I don't think most people understand how severe it is to be convicted of a DABI. There's a whole bunch of collateral consequences as well as criminal consequences. You know, and you know, you think, well, I'll get a traffic ticket. No, no, no. For gross misdemeanor, you get to a year in a slammer. So if a person's been through it and has to go to treatment and stuff, they know that it's more severe. And that's directly contrary to Judge Baker's argument, his findings.
And so, although in the Brooks case, the Supreme Court said that, I'm sorry, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I
apologize. In the Brooks case, the Supreme Court said that a driver's decision to agree to take a test is not coerced simply because Minnesota has attached a penalty of making it a crime to refuse a test. So In being told that it was a crime to refuse the test, how did that make it coercive then, based on the Supreme Court's holding with Brooks?
I
understand the partial inaccuracy, but...
Yeah, in Brooks it wasn't inaccurate, you know, and they said giving them an accurate advisory, you know, wasn't necessarily always coercive, so that the person loses their possibility of freely and voluntarily consenting to a search. The Brooks kind of had a list of considerations that I could address, if I may.
Sure, please.
Brooks, and it was cited in Vanderchuk versus Commissioner of Public Safety, 906 Northwest 2nd, 262. But in that, discussed, you know, that the advice regarding the penalty for refusing. At that time, it says the penalty for refusing bears on the voluntariness and whether or not it was coerced. Well, there definitely is a penalty for refusing. That's one of the considerations in Brooks. Whether or not the test could be admitted in a criminal case, refusal. Well, now I don't think it can be. Whether or not the driver retains the right to submit to testing to refuse. Well, first of all, I must not read the implied consent advisory very well, because I keep reading the cases that say, well, they have an option to refuse. Well, I don't know if we have an option to refuse. It doesn't say you can refuse, no problem. No, it says you refuse, you get prosecuted.
Right, but the statute says if you refuse, no test will be given.
The statute, but the advisory doesn't. And so if you read the advisory, you're standing there and you read the advisory, and they're telling you, you'll be prosecuted for a crime if you refuse. You're going to give us a test? That's not telling them they have the right to refuse. It's telling them if they refuse, they're going to be prosecuted.
In your reply brief, you argued, I'm going to quote it, that the determination of whether or not a statement by the officer that refusal to submit to a test is a crime is a threat is a legal issue and should be reviewed de novo. I don't believe you raised that in your first brief.
I mean, Judge. I mean, okay.
Did you argue it to the district court?
We didn't argue de novo or not the district court. We just argued the facts. Going back to Brooks, I think in Brooks, they were able to contact counsel. In this case, it weren't.
But she was given opportunities to contact
sure.
counsel.
And in particular, in this case, at that time, even if you had experience with the DWI statute, with the cases that were up the U.S. Supreme Court and the Minnesota Supreme Court, I defy anybody to say that they understood exactly what the law was at that time. So Judge Baker said, well, she has some experience, she knows. Well, I don't think anybody knew what was going on. As far as how the ultimate decisions were going to be made. And maybe somebody did, not me. I think these findings are clearly incorrect and not supported by the evidence.
And,
You submitted to this court for our consideration, reference to supplemental authority.
I did.
And that's the case of Schneider versus the Commissioner of Public Safety. Would you agree with me that the outcome of that case turned on a due process analysis?
I do.
And that was not an issue that's before us in this case, correct?
Currently, according to Jordan Bird, which I'm up for appeals.
So what other persuasive value is the Schneider case?
Okay, with the due process, it's a requirement that you show prejudice. And with Schneiderman, is it Schneider? Schneider, excuse me. With Schneider, although it was a due process to show the prejudice, the argument was that the incorrect advisory caused them to consent. And I don't know how you, so the voluntary consent issue is what caused Schneider to be a due process violation. I don't see how you can separate out. You give them an incorrect advisory and they consent and that's your prejudice. Well, the relationship, I think, can hardly be separated. The voluntary consent or the loss of voluntary consent is what caused prejudice in Schneider. And I don't know how
you... We don't have the ability to make a due process related decision because that's not an issue that you raised in the district court in this case.
Basically, that's what the court said, yeah. And then, but it's relevant, again, this discussion about Schneider where he says, I'm taking a test because I'm going to be starting as a client. He goes directly to the heart of the issue on voluntary consent. And that's why I cited it. And I think it's just about identical, except for the fact that in Schneider, he was in the hospital, not in jail. He wasn't in handcuffs. His vehicle hadn't been impounded, and he hadn't been transported by the cops, which are all intimidating and coercive activities. Although it might be protocol, the protocol is still coercive. So in Schneider, he doesn't have any of those things, and they still threw it out basically on the fact that the incorrect advisory caused him to consent. Okay. So that's basically all I have to say right now.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Good morning, Your Honors and Counsel. May it please the Court. William Young, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of Respondent, Commissioner of Public Safety. At the outset, I'm just going to respond to a couple of the points that were made by Your Honors and Mr. Malone in response. Judge Burke, at the very end, you were talking about the Schneider case, and there was a mention that this wasn't raised below. I think just to clean it up, it was raised the first time, but it was not remanded on the due process issue, because on the first appeal of this matter, this Court found that there was no evidence raised to create such a record, and pursuant to the Supreme Court's Johnson and Morehouse decisions, there's no reason to remand back on the due process issue, only on the consent issue.
Because it hadn't been raised in the district court in the first instance.
Correct. And so when it was remanded back this time, it was not remanded back on that issue, and so on this appeal, there's nothing raised below, but it had initially been mentioned, but no evidence was put forth to support that claim in the first instance.
But as Mr. Malone indicated, I mean, there is a relationship between, you know, the question of whether the inaccurate advisory made the consent involuntary or coerced the consent. I mean, that is related in sort of a practical common sense way to the due process analysis, isn't it?
Absolutely. It is one of the factors for the district court to consider, or that was considered by the district court, and for this court to consider on review. It's one of the factors that was mentioned in the U.S. Supreme Court in the Bernard or Birchfield case. When they remanded back on the civil side of things, when, you know, they resolved the criminal issues, but the civil was remanded back for that consideration. And so it is one of the factors of the Supreme Court, the Minnesota Supreme Court, when they discussed consent in Brooks and similar cases, has mentioned that this is one of the many things, along with the type of person, do they have a chance to talk to an attorney, or as Judge Cochran actually pointed out, not did they chance to talk to an attorney, but do they have the opportunity to, is what is actually the standard for that element to be considered. Additionally, you know, what was said and how it was said. Here, what was said was an accurate advisory. I would note, it is the same advisory that was read in Brooks. And so, granted, the the following appellate cases that have now clarified that it wasn't inaccurate advisement that violated due process.
Right, I mean, we now need a warrant. Law enforcement needs a warrant for urine and blood tests, which was not the case at the time Brooks was decided.
Absolutely. I guess what I'm just pointing out is that it's the same advisory that was read in Brooks that was considered as one of the many totality of the circumstances. It's not as if this was a new advisory that was read that was different. And you know, in Brooks, they talked about the type of person and their past history of law enforcement. Brooks had, I think, three different cases pending at the time of the Brooks decision. He obviously had priors as well because he was already at a felony level. But here, this is Ms. Arndt's third interaction with law enforcement on DWIs. As the district court found, she was experienced with this process below, and the district court found that to be one of the reasons why it didn't render her consent invalid, that she voluntarily consented to the advisory. The district court made that determination based upon her history, what was said, his credibility determinations, finding that the police officer or deputy Sentinel talked in a calm, clear manner, that he rejected the testimony that he'd been yelling at her and screaming at her. Again, also the fact that she had an opportunity to attempt to consult with counsel twice in this instance. And so when you throw all those things together, it is one of those factors, but I think the district court's finding is not clearly erroneous because it looked at exactly the factors that they've been told, they've been advised by the courts in Brooks, in Peschel, Schneckeloff, the U.S. Supreme Court's consent analysis. It is a totality to make that factual determination, and so the district court's finding using all those factors was not clearly erroneous. Absolutely, some things cut against a finding of the voluntary consent. One of them may be the partial inaccuracy of the advisory, but the district court weighing all of those together found that it was still voluntary consent to this breath test.
Counsel, what about appellant's point that appellant was handcuffed and put in the back of a squad car and then taken to jail and handcuffed to the wall? I mean, doesn't that indicate a lack of indicate coercion as argued by appellant?
Those are factors to be considered by the district court, and in pretty much all the times when the advisory has been read, both whether it's inaccurate or accurate, whether it's going to be a breath test or a blood or urine test, the person being read the advisory is in custody. In some situations, they are read in the squad cars, and others in police stations. Sometimes they're handcuffed, sometimes they're not. In the Brooks case, the Supreme Court discusses that those are among the totality of factors that need to be considered for making that consent analysis. It wouldn't be a dispositive factor, it's just one of the many things for the court to consider. They were considered, or was considered in this case, by the district court, but the ultimate determination that it was not, that it was still voluntary consent was not clearly erroneous when the district court encompassed all those factors, said here's everything that was going on, and considering all those things, this was still voluntary consent by Ms. Arndt to the urine test.
The district court seems to emphasize that law enforcement was following protocol here. Does it make a difference if the protocol involves being handcuffed once you're in the holding room of the sheriff's department? Seems to me that's a factor that could make a situation more or less coercive. And the fact that it's protocol in that law enforcement department to handcuff people once they've already been taken into custody may be different in other words, in a different department. Does that make a difference?
It could. It's again part of the totality. I think if law enforcement's simple argument is protocol, and therefore you can't be second guessed or questioned as a whole, I think that would be concerning. But again, it goes to that whole totality of what happened here. She did have one hand removed to make the phone calls, so it wasn't as if she was being deprived of access to a phone or phone books or a flip through or to contact anybody. I know she was still, the other hand was still handcuffed to whatever it sounds like a bar or something on the wall. I think it does go to the totality of the factors that should be considered, but I don't think it makes the district court's finding clearly erroneous that she did not voluntarily consent to the test. I don't have anything additional, Your Honors, if there are no other questions. I guess I could briefly talk about the second issue that was raised, which was the request that the courts have an adverse inference because the video wasn't offered. I know there weren't any questions asked in the first instance about that, but briefly, there's no record evidence that the commissioner even had the video. It is not a piece of evidence the commissioner is required to get under the mandatory discovery under the implied consent statute. The deputy testified that the state should have it. The state could have been the prosecutor. Who knows how he interpreted that question to be. And even if that instance Again, the average inference rule doesn't even require a mandatory inference, it's just permissive. And so because there's no record evidence that the commissioner even had it, it's not something the commission was required to have in the first instance, there's no reason for the district court to have taken an inference. Additionally, it's the testimony of Ms. Arndt and Deputy Sineau, they talked about what would have been on the video in the first place. And so the court did hear direct evidence as to what happened in their dialogue and their discussion and made findings on that. And so that wouldn't be a reason to reverse the district court as well. So there's no questions. The commissioner would just ask that the court sustain the revocation or affirm the district court.
Looks like there are no more questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Malone, you have 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use it.
I actually don't have any yet, Judge.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The case is submitted then, and we'll have our decision out within 90 days.